But another way of saying it is, I would just put, I can't think of any density operator as coming from a larger field of space that I'm not looking at half. Right. Of course, the state is not unique. Could be many different states that do that in that space. And I demand that the dimension of the field of space, the total field of space AB, is at least the square of the dimension of the field of space A. Is that the theorem understood? Question?
You might be getting to this, but I've heard that you can interpret measurements as channels where you just sort of ignore the output, and then Lyman oscillation theorem becomes a corollary to this.
So this you could apply to channels?
You're going to see it. Problem with quantum channels is that Yeah, sorry about that. Maybe I'll repeat because of no audio for people who are seeing it from home. I just presented a restricted version of Steinsprung dilation theorem that tells me that if I have a map T that maps physical states into physical states, I can think of it as some unitary operation acting in a larger Hilbert space and tracing out the Hilbert space B, half of it, and reduce the Hilbert space A. And in particular, I can interpret that. So one corollary, if you want, of this is that I can think of any partial state rho A, any density operator rho A, I can think of it actually coming from a tracing, partial trace of a subsystem B in a larger Hilbert space, including the Hilbert space for A and B. Yeah, that's a theorem. Now you said, can you repeat the question?
I've heard that, I don't know the details of this, but you can imagine measurements as quantum channels in which you just sort of ignore the output in a certain sense, and then you can apply this theorem, and that the corollary you get Nyquist dilation theorem.
That's right. That is correct. In fact, you're going to do a tutorial today about that stuff. So you're going to prove that theorem today as a part of the tutorial. So now you can say, I've heard. You say, I've done. I know it's true. That's correct. The problem with all this is that formalizing, and you will see, quantum channel theory, right, is possible to do in a course of 1 month, and you also want to see other things. A lot of stuff that you have to do. So in today's tutorial, you're going to get a little bit about quantum channels. You're going to have POVMs emerging out of precisely that unitary evolution in a larger Hilbert space. So the other dilation theorem. And you're also going to see quantum channel capacities, classical channel capacities of quantum channels and quantum channel capacities. But again, more as in like the tutorial is going to be interesting to read and learn because we don't have the time really in the lecture, unfortunately, all that. Keep in mind in books, Mark Wilde has a really great book on quantum information. Channels, channel capacities, and all stuff is about chapter 20 something. So it needs to introduce a lot of stuff until you get there, right? So again, in a 1 month course, it would be very ambitious to talk about that. Again, we're going to do it in the tutorial. Erickson and Philippe have worked a lot on that tutorial too. So you see that you're going to see that there's a lot of interesting stuff there, hopefully. It's the two tutorials that you have this week, double tutorial. Anyway, more questions about that? Now, a little bit of interpretation on this. This is what's behind an interpretation. I said, because I was hoping that somebody in particular that has opinions about this would be here, but it's not. This is what is behind what is called the church of the larger Hilbert space that you may have heard about, right? Telling you, okay, we have the notion of, as I mentioned at the beginning, the notion of classical ignorance in a way, which is, I don't know what state I have. I have a probability distribution over states, an ensemble, if you want, of states. So about every particular state, I don't really know what it is. I only know the probability distribution. I have information about it, but I know the probability distribution of getting the different pure states from an ensemble, and I got one, and I don't know which one I have. And I told you about that being the reason why we need density matrices, right? It's not enough with vectors in a Hilbert space. So we talked about this kind of ignorance, but we also said that there's a different kind of a source of ignorance. I said, right, entanglement, and I actually define entanglement as the property that a bipartite state would have, that when I erase one of the subsystems, if I know everything or I know something about the bipartite system, I erase one of the subsystems, then I lose information about the other one. Remember? And when that happened, I said, you have entanglement. This is telling you, or you can interpret this rather, as saying, so there's really no classical ignorance. That's not a thing. Classical ignorance is the result of entanglement in a larger Hilbert space that you're not seeing. Because you can always think of any state with classical ignorance, right, as coming from, no, somebody in a larger Hilbert space would know, but because we don't have access to all of it, and there is entanglement, then I have classical ignorance. So what we call the church of the larger Hilbert space would be saying there's no such thing as ignorance. There's entanglement and inability to access the whole universe. Does that make sense? This is interesting, right? Because thermal states are also mixed. So thermality also comes from entanglement. And indeed it does. Huh? You can think of a thermal state of any system as being an entangled state in a larger Hilbert space. That's what happened with the two-mode squeeze states or the thermal field dual, which is the same thing. Make sense, everybody? Now, this is interesting. The theorem, technically, at least the restricted version, is easy to prove for finite dimensions. Becomes a little bit tricky in infinite dimensions, but it's fine. You can still do this in infinite dimensions. Of course, this thing doesn't make sense anymore if you have infinite dimensions, right? So you need to be careful when you do it. Basically, this thing, exporting most of the things that we talk about here to infinite dimensions requires care. And by care, I mean a lot of care. But you can be a physicist about it and do it, see what happens, and then face the problems when they come. There are two options. Right? To actually justify why this is OK for infinite dimensions, you need some amount of background. Does that make sense, everybody? All right. So, questions. What are your thoughts about that? Do you believe in that? Do you believe in the Church of the Larger? This is just that you see the dilation. We call this the dilation of rho, or a dilation of rho. It's not unique, obviously. It's unique modulo unitary operation, right? And because I can put unitaries here, and that's nothing, right? Not local unitaries, as in like bipartite unitaries. So again, is this true? Meaning, like, is there no such thing as classical ignorance? What do you think? When I tell you pick a ball and don't tell me the color, my ignorance is actually entanglement. What are your thoughts about that? You have any?
Could you give the argument again for why there can be no such thing as classical ignorance?
Right, because every time you have classical ignorance, you can think. So again, this is not an argument like implication. It's an interpretation, huh? So, because you can think of classical ignorance as coming from, always as coming from entanglement, interpretation bit. What if all ignorance comes from entanglement? Because no matter the ignorance you have, I can always think of it, mathematically at least, I can think of it as entanglement. You see, and that factor is in with things like many worlds interpretation and other things, right? If you have access to a restricted part of the system, then something is going to emerge for you. If for you, the fundamental parts, imagine that you are building a fundamental part about fundamental theory about the universe. But it so happens that your universe is larger. It's just that you don't have access to a lot of it. So in your universe, you're going to have ignorance. But maybe that ignorance is not intrinsic to your universe. Maybe that ignorance is the manifestation of entanglement in a larger Hilbert space. And that's that interpretational way, right? If you want. There's no such thing as losses, loss of information, ignorance. It's only scrambling, right? Basically, you say, right, all these things basically unitaries in a larger Hilbert space. So information cannot be destroyed. In quantum mechanics, we know that information cannot be destroyed, right? Information can be scrambled. You can shred paper, but somebody with enough patience and resources can put together back the piece of paper, right? After putting it through a shredder, right? Quantum mechanics is telling you that. I don't create information. I don't destroy information. I just scramble information. Now, it could be that your universe originally had some degree of ignorance for some reason, or it could be that you're just looking at a part of the universe, right? And if you believe in quantum mechanics, then information cannot be destroyed, and therefore, ignorance is just coming because things are very scrambled outside of our reach. Does that make sense? What do you think?
I think my trouble with this is ignorance to me feels like a very anthropomorphic concept.
Well, ignorance understood as entropy, right? Understood as non-pure states.
That interpretation, yeah, then I'm okay with it, I guess.
But you see that when we describe things that we get from ensembles, right? Literally, that's it. So it's entropy. So your ability to not know, your inability to know, actually. Remember, informational channel entropy, right? That is entropy. Your inability to actually know what you have in your hand is what we call ignorance. And that is typically that. So if I know nothing about it, well, yeah, it's a homogeneous distribution of all possible options. See what I mean? That's the notion of entropy. That's the formalization of ignorance. We don't have a better one. See what I mean? Like, if you want to formalize ignorance, and it's the one that makes sense, at least the most sense, right? Sure, we can talk about the difference between knowledge and ignorance. Knowledge is more human. Versus ignorance in the informational sense, right? Which is clear what it is. It's your inability to predict the outcome of a measurement, for example. That's ignorance. I ignore something, then I don't know what's going to happen. If I know everything about something, I know what's going to happen when I measure. That's what I call ignorance. So any notion of ignorance defined like that can be thought of as entanglement in a larger Hilbert space. Whether that's the case or not, that's not claims. This is an interpretation. It's not called church because it was act that day, right? Because you have to believe. Does that make sense?
So which part are you saying is interpretation?
Like, well, you
interpretation or like us?
This is mathematically true. Yeah. Now, whether you want to think there's no such thing as ignorance, then it all comes from it.
That's interpretation.
You could think of it as coming from it. That's the thing. It's whether, because it can exist, probably exist kind of thing. But it makes total sense. You see, it's like, it would make sense that ignorance comes from entanglement in a larger Hilbert space. But again, it's an interpretation thing. So you may have thoughts.
Do you know of any ways that people interpret this differently?
There's such thing as fundamental ignorance, and it's not coming from this. You can always purify it like that, but it's a fiction. Okay? That Hilbert space doesn't exist. You could think of it the opposite way, right? So imagine a
plot. The universe didn't start in a pure state.
You don't want the universe to start in a pure state. Sure, but the thing is, people would tell you, if your universe doesn't start in a pure state, then there's a bigger universe where it does. Always, there is. So that's the point of the theorem. The point is that there always is a universe.
After pure state.
That's right. It's called the purification of your state. So people would say, why not consider that larger universe as the universe? Now, again, it's interpretation, right? There are people who tell you, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, more little question. Like, is this also a uniqueness theorem in any way?
No. This thing is unique, modulo non-local unitaries on this.
Okay, because I was trying to now understand in what sense it's the justification for us saying before always there's a non-unique purification. Like, it seems so similar.
It's not unique. The purification is not unique.
So was this the theorem behind all these examples we were finding?
So what examples are you talking about?
Finding purifications of some state.
Right. Yeah, that's the theorem behind it. Yeah. But I'm not sure I understand the question. What's the question again?
It's from the tutorial. Are you talking about it?
Yeah. Yeah. But finding pure states that purify a mixed state. It's certainly what this theorem is about. Can you always find it? The answer is yes, you can. Is it unique? No. In fact, it's very non-unique, right? It's not. There are two ways of making it not making it different. Trivially, one is unitaries, and also, well, I can increase the dimension, right, of the other one, and then add trivial stuff to it. Yep.
Would you agree that if you're a realist, and specifically like a psionticist, or someone who supplements this psiontic view with additional hidden variables, that there is a maximum? It's like you can only apply this theorem so many times, a finite number of times, before you get to the largest Hilbert space, whose states correspond to the elements of reality, and you can't go beyond that.
Okay.
So this theorem only applies up to some threshold, and that threshold is that you get to the wave function of the universe, and you can't go beyond that.
Sure. Once you have a pure state, you're done, yeah?
Yeah, so okay. So that's where my interpretation comes in. That.
Okay, what's your interpretation again? Summarize it.
Well, I mean, it's Everett, pretty much.
Ah. Yeah, sure. So there's many worlds. Yeah, I agree. This thing plays well with many worlds. It's nice. I like it. I like the dilation theorem.
It should not, the A should not be there in the trace.
Oh, geez. I'm sorry. Should have told me earlier.
But what I just said is true, not just of Everett, though. It's true of any psiontic theory.
Agree. Now, another person may tell you, and it's not me, but another person may tell you, but how is that an element of physical reality? You can't really access it, right? If you can never access it, is that an element of physical reality? But that's a question for philosophy, right? Because imagine the amount of things that I can think of that I can't really access, but are mathematically consistent with the theory. I can make horrible things.
But it still informs how you think about physics in general.
It depends on who you are, right? Because if you think that all physics have to be written in terms of outcomes of measurements that you can actually do in a lab, then presentation, art. Then maybe people will disagree. You see what I mean? It depends on what you call physical reality.
I'm saying that those philosophical priors inform how you think about physics.
That's right.
That's what it's for.
think I left my my charger at the university. It's still there, meaning in a classroom. So we can work until my battery. Hopefully we'll make it through. It's a Mac, yeah. It's a USB-C. But yeah, I unfortunately left it there, and there's a chance it's no longer there. I guess I'll find out tomorrow. Oh, yeah. Why is this not projecting? Could be. Select an input, maybe A. Let's do A. Oh, there you go. Right, so I was thinking of talking a little tiny bit about something related to relativistic quantum information and what we've seen in the course, which is the measurement problem once we take it to QFT instead of quantum mechanics. Because there are more things, more subtleties, if you want, that will appear when we do that, right? And before we change to quantum information processing and quantum computing for the course, let's revisit a little bit the measurement problem. So you know what RQI is, probably, but basically RQI tries to deal with gravity and quantum information. That's the idea. I'm not gonna make a lot of, I'm gonna do a lot of self-promotion here. Apologies for that, because I've worked on this problem a lot. There are other people who have, but I'm gonna tell you about my thoughts, right? So take this with a pinch of salt, right? Because it's some facts and some facts, but that I worked on, okay? So admitting my bias there. So here's a question. What does that mean to place a qubit on space-time, right? Can I just do things like that? Like, can I localize qubits and that's okay? I can. Remember what a qubit is, huh? A qubit is a two-level quantum system. For example, it doesn't have to be a qubit, but a quantum system that you use for storing quantum information. But you need to be able to access it and measure it. We call it a qubit. Does that make sense? How do you prepare it? How do you do that in QFT? So let's talk about the measurement problem. So the measurement problem, we know, is a problem already in quantum theory. In regular quantum theory, it's a problem, right? We talked about it. So proposal for measurement, right? At least some measurements can give values. So I can do experiments, and at least some of the measurements that I can do can give me a result that is a number. Make sense? It's a reasonable proposal, I would say. So for example, I have here authority, yeah, that we can write on a notepad, right? Some experimentalists can present experimental results. There's at least some measurements that do that. So in quantum mechanics, we model this with idealized measurements, as we saw, PVMs. So non-degenerate, so if you have a non-degenerate observable, idealized measurements is once you've made the measurement, you do a state update for a rank one projector on the spectrum of the measure observable, right? Right. At least effectively, you see, I said some, right? So we should be fine. And of course, we have the problems that we talked about in class, right? Which I'm not going to repeat, but you could just not care. You can just work without actually caring about that in quantum mechanics, right? As it was discussed here, like, oh, sure, okay, I can think of it as an effective theory. I know it's inconsistent with quantum mechanics, right? It's inconsistent with relativity, although we will discuss that more in detail here. But I can think of it as an effective thing, which is fine, right? Sometimes I'll have POVMs, fine, but still these ones, I just don't care. Make sense? And you can keep doing quantum mechanics. I re-emphasize, right? Still an open problem, though. It's not that it's solved in quantum mechanics. But we discussed that in class. So what happens when you move to QFT? Mind that I want to measure a localized observable. And by localized, I mean localized in space-time. Which is exactly right. So the electric field in my room, right? Well, I'm just giving this talk. That is a well-defined problem, measuring that. And it's not unthinkable that you could get, for example, 42 volts per meter. It's more or less it's the order of magnitude of the electric field on the surface. So if you measure it, it's not unthinkable that you get that value, right? I have a machine that measures that, and it says 42, right? Volts per meter. Now, the moment that I say something that doesn't sit well, it will probably happen. Stop me. Important. That's the question we want to address here. Can you just not care in QFT? Oops. And then we go to Raphael Sorkin in 1992. Raphael Sorkin wrote this paper called Impossible Measurements on Quantum Fields. He was Syracuse back then. Then he moved here, by the way. You know that, right? He was here. Now he's still here, but he's retired. Also emeritus, if you want. Great guy. So you have the chance to chat with Raphael Sorkin about these issues. Do it. Okay? You learn a lot. Raphael Sorkin, somebody, every time I talk with him, I learn. Anyway, so let me just summarize that paper for you. Okay? Because he does it very simply. First, he does two parts. Two examples. First, something very easy to think about. Nothing relativistic about it. Two qubits. Okay? And he says, well, I have a two-qubit system. I consider a state 0A, 0B. I perform a local unitary on A. I make a Bell measurement, which is projecting to that, right? But for example, mind that you get that result out of the Bell measurement. And you update, projecting into that state. And then you say, well, the expectation of observables on B now has gained information about the unitary on A. And I ask, is that surprising? Shouldn't be, right? Because this projection, this measurement is not local. So obviously, this measurement is going to make information about A reflect on the partial statistics of B. That's the issue. That's the non-locality. That's where the problem, quote unquote, comes, right? That makes sense, everybody? Understood? Okay.
Could you repeat again? We are saying we make a unitary measure.
First, you do a unitary on A, but then you do a non-local measurement on a Bell basis and say that you get a result. So then the system B has learned about what happened on A. How has it learned? Well, yeah, for example, compute the expectation of observables on B. They're going to depend on the unitary you did on A. But that, again, shouldn't be surprising, right? Because you did something non-local. As the cheating, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, who's to say that we can make that measurement?
Oh, nobody. Nobody's saying anything yet.
Okay.
Make sense? There's nothing here that prevents me from doing it. This is not relativistic yet. Let's talk about it. Oh, it's more subtle than what you think, probably. If you think it's, oh, instantaneous signaling, it's not that. It's worse. You'll see. Okay, part two of the paper. First of all, Sorkin does that to show you how, if you do something not local, right, you're going to, a non-local measurement update rule will actually convey information, right? Exchange information between the two parts of the system, which is not surprising, but he does that in the paper, right? Okay, another example. Imagine that I have a quantum field now and consider a state rho. Oops, I perform a local unitary, so I'm going to do, now I can talk about space and time, right? I'm going to perform a local unitary on this region, some region that is localized in space and time. Make sense? Now I'm going to do a projective measurement that is very non-local. Look at this projective measurement. By the way, this projective measurement people model in the lab. We can talk about, so if you're going to be concerned about this being too demanding, we're going to discuss all the demands. Let's not worry. But keep in mind, people do these things, regardless of what I'm going to tell you, people do the thing a lot. For example, let's measure the energy of the light. It's 7. You know, you're measuring, you are in principle projecting on a basis of plane waves. Because those are the eigenstates of your Hamiltonian, your foliation of spacetime, right? Plane waves of a given frequency. What people call sometimes photons, right? This thing is, if you project on that, on energy eigenstates, you're measuring the energy, it's very non-local. But anyway, we can discuss that later, because that's not the key either. And then, of course, I get now that the expectations of observables localized in this other region, which is space-like separated from A, now have learned about what you did on A, the unitary you learned on A. Make sense? Which is very parallel to what we saw before with the Bell state, right? Because you're doing a non-local projection. Make sense so far?
It's really agnostic to interpretation. It sounds like you're still...
The paper is not. What I'm saying is, so I'm removing the last part of the paper in this explanation, because then Sorkin gives ideas of what should be done instead. Sorkin has opinions, a lot of. I'm just going to remove that for that to make it agnostic. And now it's kind of fake in a way, right? Because I'm going to discuss my own way of thinking. Sorry about that. Anyway, so you have this non-locality in the measurement, correct? Then there was this problem. And basically, at the very least, if you actually use these non-local measurements, if you actually claim that I measure energy, for example, in an optical cavity, you're going to have this problem. Go ahead.
I didn't understand how is we're making some projection on
A full slice in this case of spacetime. Yep.
So and then what is B now?
B is a undefined observables on B. So this is a region where I'm going to compute expectation of observables. For example, the field amplitude in that region of spacetime.
Okay.
Makes sense. Remember, now my algebras of observables are slightly more complicated. We will discuss that because that's the key, actually. My algebras of observables are tough. So it's no longer, if I have a qubit, I know what my algebra of observables is. It's very easy. I'm very finite. I'm very type one. Now in a quantum field, it's no longer the case. So think of a localized observable, say the electric field amplitude, for example, on B. And I compute the expectation of that electric field amplitude on B, on the region B. And it depends on the unit area did on A. If you do this non-local projective. Make sense? So how did I learn about this? Well, in RQI, in the origins, well, not really the origins, RQI is older than that. In my origins in RQI, when I joined RQI, that was during my PhD thesis, people were using, we're talking 2010 or so, people were using this kind of measurements. They assume that you can do energy measurements and things like that. For example, optical cavity, I can measure the energy of light. People do it in the lab, right? And then trying to see relativistic effects. People were doing these things. And Faye Dawker wrote this nice paper. It's really very nice because it's very short and very concise and very to the point. Useless qubits in relativistic quantum information. Of course, that's going to caught attention if you write that. So Faye wrote this and she said, I draw attention to previous work that shows that the observables corresponding to relativistic quantum field modes, commonly employed in papers on relativistic quantum information, also in quantum optics. But you see the difference. In quantum optics, people don't really care, ironically, people don't really care about relativity that much. Because we know light is not relativistic, right? Bad joke. But what I mean is that they actually look at degrees of freedom in which several approximations can render it like quantum mechanical-like system. Huh? They don't care about the relativistic nature of the system they're doing. But importantly, in RQI, you do care. That's the whole point. Makes sense? Cannot be measured by ideal measurements. And basically, this paper is a summary of the Sorkin problem and pointing to the Sorkin reference. That was an eye-opener for me. I didn't know about the Sorkin. Sorkin paper wasn't that very well known, at least not in the people that I used to talk with. I don't know if you knew it, for example. It's a very fundamental one for QFT. So people in RQI follow two paths after that paper, if you want, after that happened. One is the one that I'm going to talk about, meaning like this is what my preferred option would be. And the other one is, it's important to consider because it's like, come on, your problem is obviously this, right? The problem is that your projective measurement is very non-local. That's not really more than anything physical, right? It's not okay. So if I restrict the projective measurements to be in a region of spacetime, right, couldn't I be okay? It's the slice problem. Why a slice? Does that make sense? All right. So can we solve the issue by disallowing two non-local kind of measurements? Well, the answer is both yes and no. Let's see, a naive read. So if just naively what I told you, right, instead of take what I told you, a naive way of reading this out is saying, yeah, sure, the problem is that, so we'll get rid of that. Don't let this piece leak out of a light cone, right? You'll be fine. Well, let me give you a summary. Impossible measurements revisited. In this paper, they consider exactly that, that the measurements are done in finite regions. So in this paper, they discuss that, well, it's more than that. But basically, they discuss the problem does not disappear by localizing the projective measure. Okay, and let me give you an intuition as to what's behind that. It's an old paper too, 1995. More ado about nothing. Michael Redhead, algebraic QFT. You know Michael Redhead? See, that's the problem. Nowadays, people don't learn QFT. Very sad. They just learn high-energy physics. QFT, foundation of QFT, right? It's a very interesting paper. It's about the Riesz-Leder theorem. Do you know the Riesz-Leder theorem? No? Okay. Homework for you, not for this course. If you're interested in QFT and foundation of QFT, learn about the Riesz-Leder theorem. The implications are really non-trivial. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that, but it's a very interesting abstract, right? I'm not going to read too much, but they ask these key questions. What is it really, when you're making a measurement, what is it really that you're measuring in a quantum field? And things like that. I'm going to just draw you to theorem one of this paper. Theorem one tells you that, so R parentheses O is the set of the local algebra, is the local algebra of observables of a quantum field in a region of spacetime. Say this room during my lecture, right? And I define all the observables that you can have of the electromagnetic field. Makes sense? The formal algebra, of course, right? And I call that algebra R0. And this tells me that if the P being the projector associated with the state update, so in mind that I update the field by a projective measurement, okay? I do a measurement of one of those observables. If P is in the local algebra of observables associated with the region of spacetime, O, then P is an infinite dimensional projector. The proof is actually pretty neat. Basically, the proof goes with the classification of algebras, right? And the particular case that we have the local algebra associated with, if you have a wedge of spacetime, right? You mind that I have one wedge, the right wedge, for example, of space. And then you know that the it's a type 3 algebra. The observables on the wedge are a type 3 algebra. The von Neumann classifications of algebras, do you know about that, anything? Functional analysis, okay. Type 3 is the horrible one. Type 3 is the horrible spectral theorem. You know spectral theorem, when we write spectral decompositions, type 3 is the one for which you don't know how to write the spectral decomposition. At least not in a very rigorous way. Makes sense? Well, again, I'm summarizing a lot. But the important thing is that you can prove there's a theorem by Drisler that tells you that the algebras of observables in the wedge are a type 3 algebra because, of course, the algebra in a restricted region of spacetime is a subalgebra of a wedge, then also has to be a type 3 algebra. It's as simple as that. And the key point here is that P has to be infinite dimensional. So a projective measurement over a bounded region of spacetime cannot be finite rank. Cannot be associated with I got a 42. Does that make sense? Because you need a rank one projector in order to associate a value to it, to do the state update. Does that make sense? That's the fact that telling you in order to actually associate it with you typically think you're measuring when you measure something, you need to have this extension a la Sorkin. Because the moment that you say, okay, I know that it's 42, then it's the whole of space-time. I know maybe 42 with some error, where you start reducing the region, but still infinite dimensional. Does that make sense? That's one of the main issues. Questions? Is that understood what the problem is? You cannot do idealized measurements in QFT. Because there's no such thing as being localized at the same time that idealized. Exactly. So the two things are in conflict. The more idealized you are, the less local you are. And of course, you will violate relativity, right? You will violate the tenet of the theory. The less local you are, sure, fine. Then I can go to rank one. So that's the same problem. But is there a compromise? Well, this paper about impossible measurements revisited talk about compromises. And what are the things? With PVMs, let me tell you, there's no compromise. Okay. That makes sense?
Can you explain once more the link between infinite dimension and
the rank of the projector? Yeah, think of the rank of the projector. If you get a 42 out of a measurement of a self-adjoint operator, the state update, the compatibility between sequence of measurements, forces you to update the state by applying a rank one projector associated with the eigenstate, associated with eigenvalue 42, for example, that you got. Make sense? The problem is that a rank one projector cannot be a localized measurement, ever. So that theorem from the paper by Redhead tells you, well, if you had a rank one projector, then it's certainly not localized. And therefore, you're going to violate all sorts of locality. You're going to be superluminally signaling when you state update, which is not allowed, shouldn't be allowed in the theory, QFT. Make sense? And you can say, OK, maybe there's a compromise. Maybe I can do a higher rank measurement with some sort of uncertainty in your measurement or something like that. Sure, the problem with PVMs is that they're very difficult. I'm not getting into the details, right? But even in those cases, they're not very localizable still. You're going to have fat tails going out. And those fat tails are going to signal.
Yeah, I don't quite see the link between what you're describing as like this and, let's say, having a bit of uncertainty in your measurement.
Right, rank one. So if you don't know the outcome.
Rank two or rank three, you're saying.
No, it has to be infinite rank.
Exactly, OK.
That's right. That doesn't work. Okay. Exactly. It has to be infinite rank. Well, I mean, again, you can think of a continuum, right? As in, like, a projective measurement that is weighted towards some value and then has infinitely many components of other values, but really kind of weighted there.
Yeah, because I thought this was...
like a Gaussian?
You drew, like, your projection like this. So when you say like this, it's not referring to the localization.
It is referring to the localization, but in a way, still localizing the whole of space-time. So it's still completely delocalized. But you can have that most of the effect happen close to the light cone, for example. And that would be not okay from the fundamental point of view, but maybe a good effective description of what's going on. But I'm telling you that even in that case, that's not okay. Reactive measurements are difficult to localize. In fact, impossible. But they even don't want to be very quasi-localized, even. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Where did the signaling come in?
Yeah. The Sorkin issue, right? Consider a state for the field, then do a unitary on a local region of space-time, okay? Then do a projective measurement that is not local. And then the statistics of the observables on B depend on the unitary you did on A.
But it's not like deterministic. You can't learn.
It doesn't matter, information. No, you can learn. Just real information. I do a measurement on B that's paid as separate, and I learn about A, about what somebody did on A. In fact, Sorkin shows you how to reconstruct the unitary that you applied on A. Yeah, it's perfect signaling. This is not, but they can't communicate. No. They communicate by this project. This has place state. When you apply this state update, you are doing FTL signaling. Does that make sense? It's a real signaling problem. All right, but it is a real signaling problem. The paper is very clear.
I thought there was a theorem that said if you have, if you do some non-local measurement like this and you impose no signaling, then you get non-determinism, and so.
But that's the point. That's the problem. This part of your state update is signaling. So you see, nobody is imposing signaling on P. What I'm telling you is that it's incompatible to impose that the measurement is at the same time projective and non-signaling. These two things are inconsistent, incompatible. You cannot. You have to choose one. So either you have idealized measurements and you do away with relativity, or you consider relativity and then your measurements cannot be projected on the field. Does that make sense? That's the whole point. So I agree with what you said. What you said is not incorrect. But the point is that there's no way to reconcile these two things. Idealized measurements on quantum fields cannot exist. Remember that I told you there are some subsystems for which idealized measurements work well? Well, there's no quantum field theory for which a projective measurement will work well.
You're saying the premises of the theorem I just cited.
It's violated by this measurement. Yeah.
Contradiction to each other.
Correct. Okay. Makes sense, everybody? Yeah.
Always drawing kind of like the measurement as something that is purely space-like.
Again?
Where are we writing the measurements being like purely space-like?
That's right. But that's what I was telling you, right? There's a theorem that tells me that the projector cannot be rank one. If the projector is rank one, it cannot be localized. It cannot be in the local algebra of observables in a localized region. Then you can say, okay, can I have like a rank five? No. It's actually, I have to be infinite rank. So it cannot be associated with one single value outcome of measurement when you state update.
No, but if you want to have it localized, but what if I don't want to localize it?
Well, then you violate relativity. That's the issue. That makes sense? If it's non-local, if the projection is non-local, then allows for signaling. That's the point. Cannot be at the same time localized and rank finite rank.
Could you just define non-local, like the non-local measurement?
Non-local meaning that the state update affects the whole slice of space.
As soon as you do it locally.
That's right. It's an instantaneous update of space like separated things. Okay. That can signal, indeed. Make sense, everybody? It's very similar to this. It's literally very similar to this for the qubit, the Sorkin qubit case, right? It's a measurement like that. You are teaching B about A through the measurement. So here you are teaching the whole of space-time, the whole of space-time in the future about what happened in this region. Yep.
And can you just define once again infinite rank in this case? Because I felt that previously we were also always looking, at least, not always, sorry, wrong word, but sometimes at infinite rank operators, but somehow the projection then chose, you know, one of the...
No, the projector being infinite rank.
So an observable, you know, we often write it in terms of, you know, spectral theory.
That's fine, but then you measure. How do you update the state after the measurement?
And that projector in there...
That is the thing that cannot be finite rank in QFT. Make sense? And if anything has to be understood out of this lecture, it's this problem. The measurement problem in QFT. Make sense? The inability of having a clear outcome of a measurement and update through a PVM, as a postulate would tell me, and the ability to localize in space-time to not violate relativity.
Makes sense.
All right. Okay, so we're here. More questions? We will move on. Because now we transit from, you know the problem now. There are many people working on trying to solve this problem, if you want, or understand what really we do in a lab when we measure quantum field. We're going to switch now to what I do. So it's very different from the general. Yeah?
I have a question. I don't feel that much to having this infinite rank projector. Is that much?
What's that?
I don't feel that much.
Oh, tell me why.
Infinite rank projector is that much of a problem?
Why?
Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, because I got in mind that the result of the measurement is 42 volts per meter, right? Yes. Then I need to apply the state update because I can do another measurement and it has to have the same value, right?
Yeah.
In order, typically, in my finite dimensional system, what would you do? Well, I update by a projection. I project over the eigenstate associated with 42. That's a rank one projector.
Yeah, but you can project on the eigenspace, right?
And then you can project on the eigenspace.
You get the same result.
Not really, no. Because 42, to get exactly 42, you need a rank one projector.
No, but 42 can be just associated to the whole eigenspace.
That's right. So, no. So imagine that it's a non-degenerate. Well, in this case, you have non-degenerate observables. 42 is associated, if you want, with that one eigenstate.
Okay. But then, can you just formulate measurements in terms not of now eigenstates, but eigenspaces in the sense that you can only...
You could, meaning I have some uncertainty in my measurement. It's not really... If you actually say the number is 42, somehow, within every accuracy that you can consider in the experiment, you need a rank one projector. There's no way out. You could have an infinite rank projector, indeed. It could be mostly 42, but also with components associated with other values for the measurement. Other possible eigenstates, if you want. The problem with this is like position eigenstates, right? They're not really states, but you know what I mean when I say that, hopefully. The other eigenstates of the operator, right? But the problem is, okay, how much can I do? There's a compromise between the two. Either I have a sharp measurement with no localization whatsoever, or I have a blurry measurement with some localization. The problem is that the trade-off is bad. So you can always have, you will always have fat tails if you can measure with any accuracy, any quantity. That can signal. That's a fundamental problem. Of course, the question is, if you go that way, it's also something I'm exploring in other people. It's like, okay, what are the fundamental limits of that compromise? Is it really something that could be effective description or not? That's a different story. But the fundamental problem remains. Incompatible to have a sharp enough outcome of a measurement, as you get in a lab, with no violated relativity in the state update part of the measurement.
Understand this part of the argument that the rank of the projector will not be one if we are trying to localize that measurement.
Correct. In fact, it will be infinite.
Yeah. Okay. Even if it is finite but not one, it will create some uncertainty.
Correct. Yes.
But the localized part. What do we mean by localizing a measurement?
It's ideally, that the effect of the measurement when I update only affects the causal future of that measurement. The measurement happens in some region of space-time, and to be compatible with relativity, it should only affect the causal future.
Okay.
And that's what's incompatible. It will always affect outside of the causal future.
So any project, any rank one projector that we usually use in quantum mechanics that...
Oh, that is horrible. That would definitely propagate. That's the Sorkin. That's what Sorkin does
in
the paper, and shows that propagates information like crazy everywhere in space-time. Make sense? Yeah.
Isn't then, like, because you can see this as the problem. I want to do QFT compatible with relativity, and then...
And you want to measure, too. Yes.
But what if I tell you, like, no, I know that I go to the lab and I measure 42, so the problem is doing fields. You cannot do fields.
Oh, well, the problem would be how do you model, right, the measurement? To me, I mean, again, you can put the problem... For me, the problem is, like, okay, PVMs are not good models for measurements that give a value. That'll be my statement of the problem. Sure, the problem could be QFT is wrong, but the problem that not going that way, because I believe QFT is not wrong, at least at the scales at which you work at the lab, right?
Do you believe fields are fundamental?
I believe it's not wrong within the limits of what you can do in a lab. See what I mean?
If you go to the foundational problem, do you believe?
No, but the problem, okay.
Do you believe fields are fundamental?
No, I believe that they are the best candidates we have for fundamental. Not sure the field themselves are fundamental, but certainly there are excitations of the field that I could consider is our best approximation to fundamental. If you make me choose between all the theories that we have, the ones that are based on QFT and the ones that are not, I would tell you that I prefer the ones that are based on QFT. See what I mean? I don't want to make absolute statements of belief, right? But I do think it's the best we can do, yeah. Make sense? Yeah.
I'm just wondering, in with these idealized measurements, is that a mathematical issue or an interpretational issue?
Both, right? It's a mathematical issue indeed. You cannot really have them compatible with causality. That's mathematical. But then the problem is, okay, what have I done in the lab then if it's not this? So this thing, this mathematical thing, cannot be modeling what I actually did in my lab to get the 42. So what the hell am I doing in the lab? That would be my way of formulating the problem. See what I mean? It's not interpretational, it's real in the sense that if this is what I'm doing in the lab, then I can signal to the space-like part of my measurement. And then I can become, I wouldn't be here if that were possible. I'll be extremely rich. See what I mean? By that I mean, because I would just learn about the stock market tomorrow, lottery. Sorry, but thing like space like allows you to send information to the past. See what I mean? Is that clear? It's not an interpretational issue. It's a very real issue, fundamental issue of the theory. Does that answer the question? This is a real problem. So if you want to say, oh, I can just sweep this under the carpet, then no, the answer is no, you can't. You have a problem. You don't know how to update states after a measurement in QFT. If you thought that you updated with a projection, if you get a number, no, that won't work. That's what I'm telling you. Make sense?
I just find it funny that people have solved this in some way similar to, like you usually say, you know, you introduce fields in order to have this commutator stuff so that you keep causality.
The problem is the projection. So again, this is not a problem with the dynamics. The dynamics of QFT are okay. The problem is this magical thing called measurement, obtaining classical information about the field, which you do. There's some process. See, this is connected. This is a really good question. It connects with what I call the relativistic cut. There is a connection. So there's in the process, you have quantum fields interacting with other fields. All of that is causal. There's no problem with that. The problem is with you writing 42 in this region. The state, the amplitude of the field was 42 during my lecture. And then in the future, somebody else comes and measures again. And they have to get, if this is right after, they have to get a 42. See what I mean? The compatibility, like Stenger-Lach, the compatibility of successive measurements, the state update. What happens when I actually get the information about the... So you see, the amplitude is in some superposition of something, right? Of amplitudes, but then I measure. And it's no longer in a superposition, it's something else, right? The measurement, the fact that I know something about the field, it will condition the probability of obtaining other outcomes in the future. I need a state update rule. That's the issue here. That the projective measurement state update rule is not compatible with causality. Not the dynamics of the QFT, the measurement. The question is, what is a measurement theory for QFT? Sorkin says, look at what Sorkin says in the abstract. No. I just really want you to understand this problem. It is argued that this problem leaves the Hilbert space formulation of quantum field theory with no definite measurement theory, removing whatever advantages it may have seemed to possess vis-a-vis that. Well, this is his interpretation. So let's not read that one. Well, you can read that one. But let's not focus on that one, because this is a way of interpreting the result for a way out. But this is important. This problem leaves the Hilbert space formulation of the quantum field theory with no definite measurement theory. That's the problem. You don't have a measurement theory for QFT. That is the problem. What does it mean to do a measurement on a quantum field? Does that make sense? By the way, this is the same as state preparation. It's one-to-one to state preparation. How do you prepare a state? Can I put a qubit in a field? How do I know that I prepare a state? The measurement problem is extremely fundamental. And in QFT, I'm telling you that the usual way we think about it, at least effectively in quantum mechanics, would not work even effectively in QFT. Hopefully that makes sense. Comments, questions?
So just to make it clear, you're making, when you think of measurements here, you're saying DVMs. You're trying to make them.
That's right. Yeah. You can think of what are the classes of POVMs that actually don't violate this. And that's related to the different solutions. What do they mean? What am I doing in the lab? If I get a 42, typically, it was that at least effectively, I was updating with a projector, right? At least effectively in quantum mechanics. In QFT, cannot be the case. When you get a 42, it cannot be a projection anymore. It has to be something else. And what is that something else? And how does that connect to what you actually do in the lab? And this actually leads to the different possible solutions to the problem. That makes sense? Yeah, today, I think it's too ambitious to tell you my proposal for solution. Understanding the problem is what we should do, because we finished at about now, no? More or less. Answer a bit more, yeah.
Is there any analog? It sounds like there shouldn't be of the quantum Zeno effect in QFT.
Sure, yes.
How would that work if you can't do?
Not like this, not with projectors. Yes, yes, but that's the second part of the talk. That's the problem. You know, it takes a while. We have to introduce the, maybe what I'll do at the end of the course, in the last tutorial or something, if we talk, because I was thinking the last tutorial to be discussion, right? I can finish this if you want, tell you possible solutions. And we can tell you, we can talk about the different people working on different ways of solving this. My solution goes, if I tell you my solution, again, but how does that even work? So I need to tell you the whole thing. My solution is, let me tell you like this. When you measure a quantum field, in the end, you have a chain of operations, right? You couple the quantum field to something else, that something else couples to something else, particle detectors, right? At some point in that chain of couplings of fully relativistic interactions, there's at least one system for which a non-relativistic approximation is good. Then in that system in particular, you call detector that system, and you do projective measurements on that system. In the moment in the chain, that things become effectively non-relativistic, as in it's a good approximation to go non-relativistic, do the PVMs there. Because now your theory, you can translate map one-to-one to algebras of observables that don't have this problem. And then compute the POVM that results on the field from having extracted the information from that detector. Keep in mind that we never measure quantum fields directly. We always measure quantum fields by coupling some detector to it. I'm measuring the electromagnetic field, so by coupling the molecules in the cells in my retina to the field, right? Are some dipoles there that are coupling to the electric field, right? Let me just show you one thing. I'm going to ignore most of what I have here, and I'm going to show you just one abstract, which is relevant. No. Show you one abstract that is relevant. Where is it? Maybe I removed it. Sorry about that. I certainly have it somewhere else. Ah, here I have it for sure. No. Yeah, that's what I want to show you. Let's read that abstract, because it's very illuminating. That's something that I always share, because I really love it. This is LAMB, right? LAMB, the Lamb shift. You know LAMB, Nobel Prize winner in physics, one of the forefathers of quantum optics. That's LAMB, very cool guy. This was in the 90s. So after Nobel Prize, and this is the thing, when you win a Nobel Prize, you can afford yourself some space to speak your mind freely, right, I guess. Anyway, it should be apparent from the title of this article that the author does not like the use of the word photon, which dates from 1926. In his view, there is no such thing as a photon, only a comedy of errors and historical accidents led to its popularity among physicists and optical scientists. I admit. What's that?
Seems optical scientists, people doing optics are not physicists.
Ah. Well, they're not. They could be an engineer. You can do engineering those things. They sign optical fibers and you say send a photon and things like that, right? I admit the word is short and convenient. Its use is also habit forming. Similarly, one might find it convenient to speak of the ether or vacuum to stand for empty space even if no such thing existed. There are very good substitute words for photon, for example, radiation or light, and for photonics, e.g. optics or quantum optics. Similar objections are possible to the use of the word phonon, which dates from 1932. Here we go. Important. Electron, neutrinos of finite rest mass, helium atoms can, under suitable conditions, be considered to be particles, since their theories then have viable non-relativistic and not quantum limits. That's where I want to leave it. So trying to talk about a photon is one of the worst mistakes you can do conceptually fundamentally when you study electromagnetism. When you have massless fields, the notion of something like a photon is horrendous in many ways. Very horrendous. It's just an attempt of our minds to try to reconcile our very classical way of thinking of balls that collide with each other with the phenomena seen in QFT, with the phenomena seen with fields, right? It's horrible. It's just, I mean, even already from very naive perspectives. Oh, a photon has, and what do you call a photon? That's the main thing. What do you call a photon? Is it a Fock excitation? One Fock excitation? Okay, then if it's a Fock excitation, I'm fine with calling a photon. I can have a wave packet of some frequency, right? Localized in space. Problem is that I cannot make it compactly supported. Thing number one, it's gonna have tails, and the tails are fat. But that's fine, it could be a wave packet, mostly localized in some frequency, right? Which is mostly localized in space, but it's gonna spill out of my lab because there are tails there. Maybe I can just neglect the tails, and I call that a photon. Then I'll be fine. But then you hear people talking, no, a photon has energy h bar omega. What do you mean? That thing is extremely localized. It existed forever and will exist forever in all of space-time. Does that make sense? There's no limit in which you can actually localize one single excitation of the electromagnetic field in a finite region. That's one of the issues that one has with that word photon. So photons are a fiction, convenient fiction, I agree. But a fiction nevertheless. They're not real. And we can discuss what you call a photon. Again, if you call this wave packet of one Fock excitation a photon, I'm fine with calling it that. I do call it that sometimes. Sorry to avoid it, but I call it that. But again, remember that thing has tails. It doesn't fit in your lab. Tails that reach everywhere. Does that make sense? Now, when you want to do quantum information, imagine. So for most cases, it doesn't matter. You can work in regimes where you don't care that much. But if you want to really do quantum information in space-time, imagine, example, imagine that you have you want to have some randomness generation. Just one task that you want to have, for example, within quantum information processing, right? I have a casino and I want to make it fair. And I know that there's no such thing as classical randomness generators, right? Because classical mechanics is deterministic. A Lagrange demon can come to my casino and get all my money, right? Good. But I have something that is, in principle, we believe, in nature, probabilistic, which is, yeah, one prepare a quantum state in some basis as an eigenstate of some observable and measure an unbiased measurement after, an orthonormal measurement. Then you know the outcome is going to be, if it's a qubit, 50-50. You get a real, real random number generator, right? Now, the problem is, okay, but my atoms, so might not use atoms to implement that, right? And I prepare an atom in some state, and I measure it on an orthonormal basis, right? Cool. But my atoms don't exist alone. There's an electromagnetic field interacting with those atoms always, right? So in this process of doing the measurement and so on, some information has been leaked to the field. Imagine that now I have a demon that is powerful enough to have access to all the light that comes out of my casino. What can that person do? Can they actually guess the random number? Because it's not truly random. You lost randomness because of the coupling to the electromagnetic field. See what I mean? When you care about those things, when you care about truly relativistic protocols of quantum information, you cannot really say, well, the tails, I don't care. Does that make sense, everybody? So anyway, I'll be happy to tell you about my proposal for solving this. I and my group, of course, not just for solving this. And there are other proposals, of course, so, and we can discuss them. If you want, if you're interested in this, I thought that it'd be nice to end the part about information extraction from the field with the measurement problem in QFT. Again, it's RQI, right? But that is also why I think that's the nice thing about having whoever teaches these courses have different backgrounds, so they can always introduce you to parts that are interesting to them, and that way you get exposed to many interesting things. I think that's the most that I'm going to do about RQI in this course, because I want to do a little bit of quantum computing. But in the last day, the discussion, if you want, we can revisit this if you're interested. Any questions before we go? Are you convinced that at least there's a problem that is worse than quantum mechanics or measurements in QFT? Nice.
What is the Riesz-Solomon
theorem? Yeah, what
was that? I'm going to take the spelling properly because my German is really bad.
The whole thing seems to rest on one theorem. What are the assumptions?
I'll just spell it, okay? I know how to write it, right? But I just don't want to make a spelling mistake that gets recorded forever. Come on, yeah.
What?
You pronounce it.
Can somebody who speaks German pronounce that? There you go.
That's a big
That's the theorem. Be careful. Be careful when you read about it. There's a lot of BS about this. As in remote state preparation, you can have a local operation here, and suddenly I create a dinosaur in Alpha Centauri instantaneously. It's related with the cyclicity of the vacuum theory, and it's related to locality. So check it out.
No, but this was not the theorem which was is at the root of this problem, right?
It's related to this problem. In the more I do about nothing, actually, that paper is about really the theorem. Yeah, be careful with what you read about. I mean, again, I would say be careful with the math and the physics you pick on the street, right? This is one of these areas where people do a lot of crazy stuff. Yeah.
Just how common is the view that, I mean, we are theoretical physicists, sure, but
yeah.
You have some model that just, I mean, breaks down. Like, I mean, there exists no perfect plane wave.
Yeah, but the problem with this is that this model breaks down at low energy. So you see, we have predictions of measurements that match the theory to the 14th digit in QFT, and yet we don't have a fundamental mechanism to update the state with measurement. See what I mean? We cannot really, we can do only one measurement and throw it out in our model. In the theoretical model, two successive measurements that influence each other, we don't know how to do in QFT. So this problem. So it's a problem of the model. Not that the theory is not good enough. It's that the theory is lacking a fundamental ingredient to be a physical theory, which is the mapping between an experimental procedure and a number to what happens in the theory sector. You see, how do I model that in the theory? And that's what's missing, believe it or not.
But is that what motivated the Nobel Prize back at the
Lamb? No, Lamb got the Nobel Prize, so that's different.
Not why he got his Nobel Prize, but why he wrote that article. I think
Lamb? No. The Nobel Prize was for the Lamb shift, for explaining.
Nothing to do with, just his paper.
Nothing to do with this, no. Well, to do, yes, it's quantum optics, right? Lamb worked in quantum optics and was one of the creators of quantum optics.
My question is, what he wrote about the photon?
This paper, yes. Yeah.
I felt this was more motivated by saying, well, it's just a model that is too idealized, it breaks down.
The problem is that Lamb is bothered by the fact that everybody uses it in the regions we know it won't work. That's the issue. That people are improperly using it. That's the issue. That's the issue. What is a photon? And when do people use like a photon? You will hear all sorts of things. Like you have some state with some energy, right? And they say, oh, what's the number of photons? Divide. It's a laser. It's monochromatic. I divide by h bar omega. That's the number of photons in there. People will tell you that. Anyway. Hopefully you got an idea at least of the measurement problem. This is a well-defined problem in the theory. And it's a very fundamental one. We are missing something fundamental for our theory. Our ability to update the state after you obtain information from it. From the point of view of a quantum information person, this is big. Because what is the effect of learning? Remember my beliefs on that, right? I'm of the opinion, and this is off the record if you want, I'm of the opinion that the state is not really ontic. The state is just containing your best knowledge about, you know, density operator, for example, contains them. It's talking about how much information you have about the system. And how does obtaining new information affect the future of my experiments? That is extremely important. It's one of the most important things and non-intuitive things in quantum mechanics. And we don't have it for QFT. Because what worked for quantum mechanics, the recipes that we have even effectively in quantum mechanics don't work even effectively in QFT. That's the main issue. There is no measurement theory in QFT as of yet. Well, I have a proposal. Other people have other proposals. There is no globally accepted, if you want, measurement theory in QFT. Make sense? We're talking about a problem that is, even though it was talked about in the 90s, people ignored it for a long time. And it's become relevant, in my opinion, it's become relevant again. Well, at least for me and for many people that I know, it's become relevant again because now we actually need quantum informational protocols. Most of them rely on obtaining information. In many protocols, the obtaining information part is crucial. What does that even mean in quantum field theory? So to do quantum information with quantum fields, you need to know that. but also connect with fundamental issues. Like, oh, I have a qubit in space-time. What does that even mean? How do you prepare that qubit? Well, I measure some subsect. You cannot, really. How? Formally, how? How do I model that, the preparation? That cannot be true. I have a state that lives in my lab. Well, what is the state beta? It's one photon. It cannot live in your lab. You have something else. You may effectively describe it as a photon for a while, but maybe at some point you're going to do something for which that model breaks down, and you don't have an alternative. Because you don't know what you've done in your lab, because what you've done in your lab is based on measurements. You see what I mean? It's fundamental, but also connects with practical issues. We get to a regime now where it matters. Makes sense, everybody? So not all QFT can be dealt with S matrix. And I'm talking free fields even. If we go to interaction theory,